dangerously ill. Suddenly, birds come out of her skin and cover her completely. 12. Swarms of gnats obscure the sun, the moon, and all the stars except one. That one star falls upon the dreamer. In the unabridged German original, each dream begins with the words of the old fairy tale, Once Upon a Time. By these words, the little dreamer suggests that she feels as if each dream were a sort of fairy tale, which she wants to tell her father as a Christmas present. The father tried to explain the dreams in terms of their context, but he could not do so, for there seemed to be no personal associations to them. The possibility that these dreams were conscious elaborations can, of course, be ruled out only by someone who knew the child well enough to be absolutely sure of her truthfulness. They would, however, remain a challenge to our understanding even if they were fantasies. In this case, the father was convinced that the dreams were authentic, and I have no reason to doubt it. I knew the little girl myself, but this was before she gave her dreams to her father, so that I had no chance to ask her about them. She lived abroad and died of an infectious disease about a year after that Christmas. Her dreams have a decidedly peculiar character. Their leading thoughts are markedly philosophic in concept. The first one, for instance, speaks of an evil monster killing other animals, but God gives rebirth to them all through a divine apocatastasis, or restitution. In the Western world, this idea is known through the Christian tradition. It can be found in the Acts of the Apostles, 3:21, Christ whom the heaven must receive until the time of restitution of all things. The early Greek fathers of the church, for instance Origen, particularly insisted upon the idea that at the end of time, everything will be restored by the Redeemer to its original and perfect state. But according to St. Matthew, 17:11, there was already an old Jewish tradition that Elias truly shall first come and restore all things. 1 Corinthians 15:22 refers to the same idea in the following words, For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. One might guess that the child had encountered this thought in her religious education, but she had very little religious background. Her parents were Protestants in name, but in fact they knew the Bible only from hearsay. It is particularly unlikely that the recondite image of apocatastasis had been fully explained to the girl. Certainly her father had never heard of this mythical idea. 9 of the 12 dreams are influenced by the theme of destruction and restoration, and none of these dreams shows traces of specific Christian education or influence. On the contrary, they are more closely related to primitive myths. This relation is corroborated by the other motif, the cosmogonic myth, the creation of the world and of man, that appears in the 4th and 5th dreams. The same connection is found in 1 Corinthians 15:22, which I have just quoted. In this passage, too, Adam and Christ, death and resurrection, are linked together. The general idea of Christ the Redeemer belongs to the worldwide and pre-Christ theme of the hero and rescuer, who, although he has been devoured by a monster, appears again in a miraculous way, having overcome whatever monster it was that swallowed him. When and where such a motif originated, nobody knows. We do not even know how to go about investigating the problem. The one apparent certainty is that every generation seems to have known it as a tradition handed down from some preceding time. Thus we can safely assume that it originated at a period when man did not yet know that he possessed a hero myth. In an age, that is to say, when he did not yet consciously reflect on what he was saying. The hero figure is an archetype, which has existed since time immemorial. The production of archetypes by children is especially significant, because one can sometimes be quite certain that a child has had no direct access to the tradition concerned. In this case, the girl's family had no more than a superficial acquaintance with the Christian tradition. Christian themes may, of course, be represented by such ideas as God, angels, heaven, hell, and evil, but the way in which they are treated by this child points to a totally non-Christian origin. Let us take the first dream of the God who really consists of four gods coming from the four corners. The corners of what? There is no room mentioned in the dream. A room would not even fit in with the picture of what is obviously a cosmic event in which the universal being himself intervenes. The quaternity, or element of fourness itself, is a strange idea, but one that plays a great role in many religions and philosophies. In the Christian religion, it has been superseded by the Trinity, a notion that we must assume was known to the child. But who, in an ordinary middle-class family of today, would be likely to know of a divine quaternity? It is an idea that was once fairly familiar among students of the Hermetic philosophy in the Middle Ages, but it petered out with the beginning of the 18th century, and it has been entirely obsolete for at least 200 years. Where, then, did the little girl pick it up? From Ezekiel's vision? But there is no Christian teaching that identifies the seraphim with God. The same question may be asked about the horned serpent. In the Bible, it is true, there are many horned animals, in the book of Revelation, for instance. But all these seem to be quadruped, although their overlord is the dragon, the Greek word for which, drakon, also means serpent. The horned serpent appears in 16th century Latin alchemy as the quadricornutus serpens, four-horned serpent, a symbol of Mercury and an antagonist of the Christian Trinity. But this is an obscure reference. So far as I can discover, it is made by only one author, and this child had no means of knowing it. In the second dream, a motif appears that is definitely non-Christian and that contains a reversal of accepted values, for instance, pagan dances by men in heaven and good deeds by angels in hell. This symbol suggests a relativity of moral values. Where did the child find such a revolutionary notion, worthy of Nietzsche's genius? These questions lead us to another. What is the compensatory meaning of these dreams, to which the little girl obviously attributed so much importance that she presented them to her father as a Christmas present? If the dreamer had been a primitive medicine man, one could reasonably assume that they represent variations of the philosophical themes of death, of resurrection or restitution, of the origin of the world, the creation of man, and the relativity of values. But one might give up such dreams as hopelessly difficult if one tried to interpret them from a personal level. They undoubtedly contain collective images, and they are in a way analogous to the doctrines taught to young people in primitive tribes when they are about to be initiated as men. At such times they learn about what God or the gods or the founding animals have done, how the world and man were created, how the end of the world will come, and the meaning of death. Is there any occasion when we, in Christian civilization, hand out similar instructions? There is, in adolescence. But many people begin to think again of things like this in old age, at the approach of death. The little girl, as it happened, was in both these situations. She was approaching puberty and, at the same time, the end of her life. Little or nothing in the symbolism of her dreams points to the beginning of a normal adult life, but there are many allusions to destruction and restoration. When I first read her dreams, indeed, I had the uncanny feeling that they suggested impending disaster. The reason I felt like that was the peculiar nature of the compensation that I deduced from the symbolism. It was the opposite of what one would expect to find in the consciousness of a girl of that age. These dreams open up a new and rather terrifying aspect of life and death. One would expect to find such images in an aging person who looks back upon life, rather than to be given them by a child who would normally be looking forward. Their atmosphere recalls the old Roman saying, "Life is a short dream," rather than the joy and exuberance of its springtime. For this child's life was like a ver sacrum vivendum, vow of a vernal sacrifice, as the Roman poet puts it. Experience shows that the unknown approach of death casts an adumbratio, an anticipatory shadow over the life and dreams of the victim. Even the altar in Christian churches represents, on the one hand, a tomb, and, on the other, a place of resurrection, the transformation of death into eternal life. Such are the ideas that the dreams brought home to the child. They were a preparation for death, expressed through short stories, like the tales told at primitive initiations or the koans of Zen Buddhism. This message is unlike the Orthodox Christian doctrine and more like ancient primitive thought. It seems to have originated outside historical tradition in the long-forgotten psychic sources that since prehistoric times have nourished philosophical and religious speculation about life and death. It was as if future events were casting their shadow back by arousing in the child certain thought forms that, though normally dormant, describe or accompany the approach of a fatal issue, although the specific shape in which they express themselves is more or less personal, their general pattern is collective. They are found everywhere and at all times, just as animal instincts vary a good deal in the different species, and yet serve the same general purposes. We do not assume that each newborn animal creates its own instincts as an individual acquisition, and we must not suppose that human individuals invent their specific human ways with every new birth. Like the instincts, the collective thought patterns of the human mind are innate and inherited. They function, when the occasion arises, in more or less the same way in all of us. Emotional manifestations, to which such thought patterns belong, are recognizably the same all over the earth. We can identify them even in animals, and the animals themselves understand one another in this respect, even though they may belong to different species. And what about insects, with their complicated symbiotic functions? Most of them do not even know their parents and have nobody to teach them. Why should one assume, then, that man is the only living being deprived of specific instincts, or that his psyche is devoid of all traces of its evolution? Naturally, if you identify the psyche with consciousness, you can easily fall into the erroneous idea that man comes into the world with a psyche that is empty, and that in later years it contains nothing more than what it has learned by individual experience. But the psyche is more than consciousness. Animals have little consciousness, but many impulses and reactions that denote the existence of a psyche, and primitives do a lot of things whose meaning is unknown to them. You may ask many civilized people in vain for the real meaning of the Christmas tree or of the Easter egg. The fact is, they do things without knowing why they do them. I am inclined to the view that things were generally done first, and that it was only a long time afterward that somebody asked why they were done. The medical psychologist is constantly confronted with otherwise intelligent patients who behave in a peculiar and unpredictable way, and who have no inkling of what they say or do. They are suddenly caught by unreasonable moods for which they themselves cannot account. Superficially, such reactions and impulses seem to be of an intimately personal nature, and so we dismiss them as idiosyncratic behavior. In fact, they are based upon a preformed and ever-ready instinctive system that is characteristic of man. Thought forms, universally understandable gestures, and many attitudes follow a pattern that was established long before man developed a reflective consciousness. It is even conceivable that the early origins of man's capacity to reflect come from the painful consequences of violent emotional clashes. Let me take, purely as an illustration of this point, the bushman who, in a moment of anger and disappointment at his failure to catch any fish, strangles his much-beloved only son, and is then seized with immense regret as he holds the little dead body in his arms. Such a man might remember this moment of pain forever. We cannot know whether this kind of experience was actually the initial cause of the development of human consciousness, but there is no doubt that the shock of a similar emotional experience is often needed to make people wake up and pay attention to what they are doing. There is a famous case of a 13th century Spanish hidalgo, Ramon Llull, who finally, after a long chase, succeeded in meeting the lady he admired at a secret rendezvous. She silently opened her dress and showed him her breast, rotten with cancer. The shock changed Lul's life. He eventually became an eminent theologian and one of the church's greatest missionaries. In the case of such a sudden change, one can often prove that an archetype has been at work for a long time in the unconscious, skillfully arranging circumstances that will lead to the crisis. Such experiences seem to show that archetypal forms are not just static patterns. They are dynamic factors that manifest themselves in impulses, just as spontaneously as the instincts. Certain dreams, visions, or thoughts can suddenly appear, and however carefully one investigates, one cannot find out what causes them. This does not mean that they have no cause. They certainly have. But it is so remote or obscure that one cannot see what it is. In such a case, one must wait either until the dream and its meaning are sufficiently understood, or until some external event occurs that will explain the dream. At the moment of the dream, this event may still lie in the future. But just as our conscious thoughts often occupy themselves with the future and its possibilities, so do the unconscious and its dreams. There has long been a general belief that the chief function of dreams is prognostication of the future. In antiquity, and as late as the Middle Ages, dreams played their part in medical prognosis. I can confirm by a modern dream the element of prognosis or precognition that can be found in an old dream quoted by Artemidorus of Daldis in the 2nd century A.D. A man dreamed that he saw his father die in the flames of a house on fire. Not long afterwards, he himself died in a phlegmone, fire or high fever, which I presume was pneumonia. It so happened that a colleague of mine was once suffering from a deadly gangrenous fever, in fact, a phlegmone. A former patient of his, who had no knowledge of the nature of his doctor's illness, dreamed that the doctor died in a great fire. At that time, the doctor had just entered a hospital, and the disease was only beginning. The dreamer knew nothing but the bare fact that his doctor was ill and in a hospital. 3 weeks later, the doctor died. As this example shows, dreams may have an anticipatory or prognostic aspect, and anybody trying to interpret them must take this into consideration, especially where an obviously meaningful dream does not provide a context sufficient to explain it. Such a dream often comes right out of the blue, and one wonders what could have prompted it. Of course, if one knew its ulterior message, its cause would be clear, for it is only our consciousness that does not yet know. The unconscious seems already informed and to have come to a conclusion that is expressed in the dream. In fact, the unconscious seems to be able to examine and to draw conclusions from facts, much as consciousness does. It can even use certain facts and anticipate their possible results just because we are not conscious of them. But as far as one can make out from dreams, the unconscious makes its deliberations instinctively. The distinction is important. Logical analysis is the prerogative of consciousness. We select with reason and knowledge. The unconscious, however, seems to be guided chiefly by instinctive trends, represented by corresponding thought forms, that is, by the archetypes. A doctor who is asked to describe the course of an illness will use such rational concepts as infection or fever. The dream is more poetic. It presents the diseased body as a man's earthly house, and the fever as the fire that is destroying it. As the above dream shows, the archetypal mind has handled the situation in the same way as it did in the time of Artemidorus. Something that is of a more or less unknown nature has been intuitively grasped by the unconscious and submitted to an archetypal treatment. This suggests that instead of